All right, buckle up, everybody. We're diving deep into the book of Exodus.
Exodus, yeah.
Specifically, we're going to be looking at the story of the golden calf and the tabernacle.
Oh, cool.
And leading our deep dive are some excerpts from lectures by Old Testament scholar Robert Van Noy. Have you heard of him?
Oh, yeah. Van Noy's great. He really makes you think differently about this stuff. Like, it's a story everybody knows.
Right.
But he just brings these fresh perspectives.
Yeah, I'm super curious about that. I mean, I'm really intrigued by, like, the whole symbolism of the broken tablets. We'll get to that, but first, let's set the scene. So, you've got Moses up on Mount Sinai getting the Ten Commandments right.
Right, the big moment.
Huge moment, right. And down below,
okay,
the Israelites are getting a little, well, restless.
A little restless, a little antsy, baby.
Yeah, it's like that whole out of sight, out of mind thing with God.
It's like as soon as Moses is gone, it's like, well, where's God?
Yeah.
You know?
Right, exactly. What are we supposed to do now? So they decide to take matters into their own hands.
Okay.
They melt down their jewelry, all this precious stuff, and create the golden calf.
And oh boy, that does not go over well.
Whoa, no. Big covenant violation right there.
Huge. Van Noy points out just how furious God is in the text.
Really?
Oh, yeah. God tells Moses, like, leave me alone so my anger can just burn against them. I'm going to wipe them out and start over with you.
Well, hold on a second. Wipe them out? That's intense.
Right. That's about as intense as it gets.
It makes you realize how seriously God takes this whole covenant thing.
It's not just some casual agreement.
No.
Yeah.
But thankfully, Moses steps in.
Right.
Right.
Takes on this role of intercessor.
Which is?
Basically pleading with God, arguing for their lives.
Wow, that's brave. So how does he do that? Like, how do you even begin to argue with God?
Well, he appeals to God's character, reminds God that he's known for mercy and compassion.
Right, right. Like, hey, this isn't really your style.
Yeah. Then he's like, think about what the Egyptians will say. They'll think you weren't strong enough to keep your promises.
Oh, smart. So he's appealing to God's reputation.
Exactly. Yeah. And then it gets really personal. Moses reminds God that these are his people, his chosen people.
Oh, wow. So he's using logic, emotion. He's pulling out all the stops.
It's a masterclass in persuasion.
And it works, right?
It does. God relents.
That's incredible. It shows the power of prayer, the power of intercession.
And not just in the Old Testament either.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Van Noy draws this parallel to James 5.1 scene where it says, the prayer of a righteous person is powerful and effective.
Okay, so the idea is God chooses to work through our prayers. But does that mean God needs us to pray? Like, is he changing his mind based on what we say?
It's a tough one, theologically speaking.
Right.
I mean, where's the line between God's sovereignty and our free will?
Right.
It's a mystery. But the Bible is clear. God invites us to partner with him through prayer.
It's like we have a part to play, even if we don't fully understand how it all fits together.
Exactly.
But okay, so eventually Moses does come down from the mountain with those stone tablets.
The Ten Commandments.
Yeah, the Big Ten. And then things get, well, a little dramatic.
Dramatic. That's one word for it.
He sees the golden calf, the Israelites partying, and he just loses it.
He throws those tablets down, smashes them at the foot of the mountain. Talk about an entrance.
I mean, some scholars, like Gispin, believe he actually sinned by doing that.
Sinned.
Yeah. They say he destroyed the work of God.
Oh, I see.
But Van Noy has a different take. He says breaking the tablets was symbolic, like a mirror of the Israelites breaking the covenant.
That's interesting. Could it be both, though? Like a symbolic act fueled by anger, a human reaction with a deeper meaning?
That's a good question. I mean, the text doesn't actually condemn Moses for it.
So maybe it was both.
Okay, so the tablets are shattered.
Yeah.
What happens next? Does he try to glue them back together?
No. No gluing. He goes straight to Aaron.
Aaron, who, by the way, tries to weasel his way out of the whole thing.
Oh, yeah, that's a classic.
The calf just magically appeared from the fire.
As if.
Van Noy compares Aaron's story to the original description of how they made the calf. Doesn't add up.
Not even close.
Aaron's trying to pass the buck. But here's the thing. Later on in Deuteronomy, we learn that Moses actually prays for Aaron.
Prays for him? After all that?
Yeah. Asks God to spare him.
There's that intercessor role again. Always advocating for mercy.
But amidst all this chaos, a surprising group steps up.
Who's that?
The Levites.
Okay.
When Moses calls out, whoever is for the Lord, come to me. They're the ones who rally to his side.
Choosing God over family and tribe.
It's a turning point. Turns a potential curse into a blessing.
How so?
Well, way back in Genesis, Jacob cursed Levi, scattered them among the tribes.
Oh, right.
But here, their actions earn them a place of honor.
Which is?
They're chosen to be caretakers of the tabernacle, the dwelling place of God.
Wow. Talk about a comeback. It makes you think, where are we clinging to old patterns, limiting beliefs? Maybe there's an opportunity for a similar turnaround.
I like that. Now, there's this passage where Moses pleads with God, asks him to blot me out of the book you have written. What book is he talking about?
The book of life.
Is that like a heavenly guest list? Is Moses offering to give up his spot?
It's not quite that simple. There are a few different interpretations. Some say it's the book of the living, like a census of everyone alive.
Okay.
Others connect it to the book of the redeemed, the ones destined for salvation.
So depending on which one it is, the meaning of Moses's plea changes drastically.
Exactly. If it's the book of the living, maybe he's offering to die in their place. But if it's the book of the redeemed, it raises these big questions about whether you can lose your salvation.
That's heavy stuff.
It is.
What does Vannoy say?
He stresses that ultimately it's God's decision who gets blotted out.
Not ours.
Right. And Vannoy points out God makes that very clear in the text.
Okay, so there's some mystery there. We don't fully understand how it all works.
Right.
But we see the depth of Moses' love. He's willing to sacrifice everything.
And when we get to the New Testament, the book of life takes on a different focus.
How so?
Well, theologian Burkauer highlights this. It becomes more about the joy and the certainty it brings believers.
Less about fear, more about God's unwavering promise.
Yeah, like a source of assurance.
So our understanding of these concepts evolves as we journey through Scripture.
Exactly. It's a journey, not a destination.
Okay, so we've got this rebellion, a shattered covenant, and Moses is caught in the middle. Where does God's presence fit into all this?
That becomes the central theme. After the golden calf, God initially decides to send an angel to lead them.
An angel, instead of himself.
Yeah, it's like he's saying, you messed up, so you don't get the VIP treatment.
I can see that. But what does Moses do?
Well, Moses, ever the advocate, pleads with God.
Again?
He argues that without God's presence, their journey is pointless.
He's not giving up.
No way. He knows it's God's presence that sets them apart, not just his power or protection.
Okay. So does God give in?
He does. Moved by Moses' prayer, he agrees to go with them.
Wow. That back and forth really shows the dynamic of their relationship.
It's a conversation, a give and take.
It's not just God dictating terms.
Not at all. It's a journey they're on together.
Now, there's this bit about a tent of meeting in Exodus 33.7 that seems to complicate things.
Complicate things.
Yeah. Some critics see it as evidence of conflicting source documents.
Like different authors, different versions of the story.
Right. But Vannoy argues that this tent is separate from the tabernacle.
Okay.
It's a temporary space where Moses meets with God outside the camp.
So the tabernacle hasn't been built yet.
Right.
So it's not about conflicting sources. It's just different spaces for different purposes.
Right. Even amidst all the chaos and disobedience, God's presence is still the focus.
Like, he's always inviting them back to that right relationship.
Always calling them back to him. And speaking of God's presence, let's finally talk about the tabernacle. This elaborate, symbolic dwelling place for God.
The tabernacle.
Yeah. It's more than just a tent, right? There are all these layers of meaning packed into it.
Oh, yeah. Tons of layers. Some even connected to the universe itself.
The universe. Okay. Now I'm really curious. But I guess we'll have to save that for part two of our deep dive. Stay tuned, folks. This Exodus journey is just getting started.
Buckle up.
Okay. So last time we were talking about the tabernacle, right?
The tabernacle, yeah.
This portable temple supposed to house God's presence among the Israelites.
Right, right. And we were just starting to get into how people have interpreted it throughout history.
All the different layers of meaning. You mentioned something about the universe.
Yeah, yeah. Some interpreters have seen the tabernacle as like a representation of the universe itself.
Whoa. Okay. How does that even work?
Well, think about it. The tabernacle have all these different layers and compartments.
Right.
And some people saw connections to, like, the structure of the cosmos.
So they're taking it pretty literally.
Kind of, yeah. Philo of Alexandria, for example, he was big on allegory. He saw all these connections between the tabernacle and, like, the planets and the stars and the elements.
So, like, the 12 loaves of bread represented the 12 months of the year, that kind of thing.
Exactly, yeah. And the seven-branched candlestick. That symbolized the seven planets that were known at the time.
It's like they were trying to decode some secret message.
In a way, yeah. But, I mean, not everyone agrees with that approach.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Patrick Fairbairn, he was a Scottish theologian, he cautioned against reading too much into the symbolism.
So what did he think was the main point?
He said the main thing is just the sheer grandeur of the materials.
The gold and all that.
Yeah, the gold, the silver, the fine linens, all these precious stones. He said that primarily represents God's glory and magnificence.
Okay, so just the fact that they were putting so much effort and expense into building this tabernacle.
Right, it shows how much they revered God, how important his presence was to them.
So it's more about the awe-inspiring beauty of it all rather than getting bogged down in the symbolism.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it.
But you did mention something about a deeper typological significance, whatever that means.
Right, right. Well, typology, that's a whole other can of worms.
We might need to unpack that a little bit.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, so think about it this way. There's a difference between a symbol and a type.
Okay.
A symbol that represents something in the present.
Okay.
But a type that points forward to something greater in the future.
So a symbol is like a logo and a type is like a foreshadowing.
Yeah, something like that. And the tabernacle, it's kind of both.
How so?
Well, it symbolizes God dwelling with his people right now in the present.
Okay.
But it also foreshadows how that presence will be manifested in even more profound ways in the future.
Okay, now I'm really intrigued. So what future reality is it pointing to?
Well, Vannoy talks about this a lot. He draws on the work of Gerhardus Voss.
Who's that?
He was a Dutch Reformed theologian. Really important figure in understanding typology.
Okay.
And Voss, he outlines several key connections.
Between the tabernacle and the future.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And they're all rooted in this core idea of God dwelling with his people.
Okay, I'm listening.
So first and foremost, the tabernacle foreshadows Christ.
Christ? Okay.
You know, like in John 1:14, it says, the word became flesh and dwelt among us.
Oh, wow. So Jesus is the dwelling place of God.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And just like the tabernacle was so carefully designed and constructed, Christ is like the perfect embodiment of God's glory and holiness.
So Christ is like the ultimate fulfillment of the tabernacle, the antitype, I think they call it.
Exactly, yeah. But Voss doesn't stop there.
There's more.
Oh, yeah. He also connects the tabernacle to the church, the body of Christ.
Okay.
You know, in Ephesians, it talks about the church as a holy temple in the Lord.
So the church becomes the continuation of that dwelling place.
Exactly, yeah. A community where God's presence resides.
And then Voss takes it even further. He says the tabernacle also points to the individual Christian.
Each individual believer.
Right. Like in Corinthians, where Paul says, your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit.
Exactly. So we as believers become dwelling places for God's Spirit.
It's like those Russian nesting dolls.
Yeah, I like that analogy.
Each one is unique and beautiful, but then you open it up and there's another layer inside.
Exactly. And then finally, Voss points to the New Jerusalem, the one described in Revelation.
That's the ultimate dwelling place of God, right?
Right. It's like the culmination of redemptive history.
Right.
Where God's presence is fully revealed.
So we've got this progression from the tabernacle to Christ to the church to individual believers, and finally to the New Jerusalem. It's like this grand story of God drawing closer and closer to humanity.
Yeah, I love how you put that.
But hold on, how do we know we're not just making these connections up?
That's a good question. Voss was very careful about that. He said we need to be grounded in the text. Like, he used the example of the scarlet cord that Rahab hung from her window.
Oh, right, in Jericho.
Yeah, some people interpret that as prefiguring the blood of Christ.
But Voss didn't buy it.
He said there's no real textual basis for that connection.
So we need to be careful not to force things.
Right. But with the tabernacle, I think the connections are pretty clear.
So we can appreciate its beauty and symbolism in its own context.
Right.
But we can also see how it points us to these greater realities.
Exactly. It's a reminder that God's plan unfolds over time, revealing more of himself as history progresses.
It makes you wonder, how are we experiencing God's presence in our lives today? Maybe there are tabernacles all around us.
That's a beautiful thought.
Now, shifting gears a bit, back to the golden calf incident.
Oh, okay.
Vannoy points out something interesting about the Levites.
Yeah?
They're the ones who carried out God's judgment.
Right. They put to death those who worshiped the calf.
It's a pretty harsh scene.
It is.
Yeah.
But it shows how serious God is about his commands.
And the consequences of disobedience.
Right. And it brings us back to that debate about Moses breaking the tablets.
Gispin said it was a sin.
Yeah, violating God's work.
But Vannoy saw it as symbolic, a reflection of the broken covenant.
Not disrespect, but prophetic drama.
And God didn't condemn Moses.
Right. He even told him to make new tablets.
So sometimes even our most dramatic actions can have a deeper meaning.
And God can use even our brokenness to fulfill his purposes.
Wow. Okay, so we've covered the golden calf, the tabernacle, Moses' intercessor. Anything else we need to hit before we move on?
Well, Van Noy talks about this interesting detail about Moses' face becoming radiant.
Oh, right. After he meets with God on the mountain.
Exactly. And, you know, there's that whole thing about the word radiant being mistranslated as horned.
Yeah, yeah. That's why Michelangelo sculpted Moses with horns.
Exactly. One little translation error and has this huge impact on art history.
Crazy. But what does Moses' radiant face actually mean?
Well, the Hebrew word can mean both radiant and horned. But in context, it's about God's glory reflecting on Moses.
Like he's carrying a bit of heaven back down to earth.
Yeah, exactly. And it's so powerful that the Israelites are actually afraid to approach him.
I can see why. Imagine seeing someone's face literally glowing.
Right. It would be both awe-inspiring and terrifying. But the point is, encountering God transforms us.
It changes who we are.
And it's not just about our own personal experience. It's about how that experience impacts others.
Like how Moses' radiant face affected the Israelites.
Right. Our encounters with God should change the way we interact with the world.
It's like we become conduits of his grace.
Exactly. Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground here. The golden calf, the tabernacle, the power of intercession.
But I understand that as we move into the final chapters of Exodus, things shift again.
Yeah, you're right. We move away from these big dramatic events and into the nitty-gritty details of constructing the tabernacle.
All the instructions and measurements.
Exactly. It's pretty technical.
Yeah.
But that's for next time.
All right. Sounds good. Join us next time as we wrap up our Exodus journey.
Welcome back to our Exodus deep dive. We've really been through it all, haven't we?
We have, yeah.
From the golden calf to the tabernacle, all these intense stories.
Yeah. Intense is a good word.
But as we get to the end of Exodus, things kind of change, right?
Yeah, it's like the tone shifts.
Yeah, it's less about these big dramatic events and more about the details, like the actual building of the tabernacle.
All the instructions and blueprints.
Exactly. It's like reading an ancient IKEA manual.
Uh-huh.
So why the sudden focus on the nitty-gritty?
I think it's more than just like, here's how you build it.
Okay.
It's about this reverence, this care that goes into creating God's dwelling place.
Right. It's not just some random construction project.
No, no. This is the place where God's presence will reside. Every detail matters.
It's like building a palace for a king.
Exactly. Van Noy talks about how every element, from the wood to the gold, points to God's holiness and majesty.
It's like the materials themselves become symbolic. And it's not just the physical structure.
Right.
The people involved, they're important too.
Okay, who are we talking about?
Well, there's Bezalel and Oholiab, these skilled craftsmen.
Okay.
And they're specifically gifted by God to do this work.
So they're not just talented, they're divinely appointed.
Right, like they're the ultimate architects.
Yeah.
And their work, it becomes an act of worship.
I never thought of it that way. So it's more than just hammering and sewing, it's pouring their hearts into it.
Exactly, creating something beautiful and meaningful for God.
It makes you think about our own work, you know? Maybe even the most ordinary tasks can be acts of worship.
If we do them with the right intention.
Focusing on God. So as we wrap up this Exodus deep dive, what are the big takeaways? Like, what can we learn from this ancient story?
That's a good question.
Hmm.
I think one of the biggest things is that God is a God of redemption.
Okay.
Even when we mess up, he's always working to bring us back to him.
Yeah, we see that with the golden calf. God's angry, but he still forgives them.
Right. And then with the tabernacle, it's like this tangible sign that he wants to be with his people.
Like, I'm not giving up on you.
Exactly. And another key takeaway is obedience.
Okay.
Throughout Exodus, you see the consequences of both obedience and disobedience.
Following God's instructions leads to blessing.
But rebelling leads to hardship. It's like God's laws, they're not just random rules.
They're guidelines to help us live a good life.
Yeah, to experience true freedom. And of course, there's the theme of intercession.
Moses, always pleading with God.
Right. He's like this bridge between God and humanity. And it reminds us we have that same privilege.
To pray for others, to intercede on their behalf. That's pretty powerful.
It is. So yeah, Exodus, it's not just some ancient story. It's about the human experience.
Mm-hmm.
Redemption, obedience, and God's desire to be with us.
It's really been an incredible journey through Exodus. We've seen the highs and lows, the struggles and the triumphs, and hopefully we've learned something along the way.
I think so, yeah. It's been a pleasure exploring this with you.
Likewise, thank you for joining us on this Exodus deep dive, and we hope you'll keep exploring, keep seeking God's presence in your own life. We'll see you next time on The Deep Dive.